You know, native gardens are pretty important, and especially in urban settings. Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Our guest says that we should not only think about what we put into our gardens, but also why we create them. Benjamin Vogt is with us from Nebraska today, and he writes a native plant gardening column and speaks nationally on sustainable design and wildlife landscape. Ben owns Monarch Gardens, a prairie design firm, and he has a new book. It's called A New Garden Ethic, Cultivating Defiant Compassion for an Uncertain Future. What does your garden do for you emotionally? How are urban wildlife gardens important to cities? What questions do you have about gardening with this in mind? Join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And of course, you can always post on our Facebook page. And again, we'd love to see your photos, especially of your native garden. Ben, hi.
Howdy, how are you?
I'm well. Thank you so much for joining us today. How are things in Nebraska?
Things are sunny and unseasonably warm.
Here too. I'm not complaining. Are you?
Yes, I am complaining.
You are?
It's not right. It's not right.
Well, I'm sure it'll change, so I think it'll be okay.
Okay, good. I need snow.
Yeah, okay. Well, Ben, how did you actually become a gardener? What interested you?
That's a very complicated question with multiple answers.
Pick the best one.
I grew up gardening. Yeah, well, I mean, I'll give you two answers real quick. I grew up with a mother who was passionate about gardening, and she dragged me outside and also dragged me to nurseries. And eventually that became a pleasure and an honor because outside gardening for her was an escape and a refuge from, well, me and other kids.
Sure.
But then, it was about 10 years ago, my wife and I bought our first home together, and it was a blank landscape, and I just went nuts spending 8 hours a day in 100-degree heat just planting and digging and planting and digging, and one thing led to another, and here I am today, crazier than ever.
Wow, 10 years, that's all it took you. That's pretty impressive. You had a go ahead.
It only took me 10 minutes, to be honest, not 10 years.
You had a great story in your book about when you first started the gardening and your reaction to finding these fat yellow, black and white striped caterpillars on your plants. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, I was spending $10 to $15 per plant at regular old nurseries, mm-hmm. and one day I spent like $1,500 at a nursery, so my investment was significant.
Yes.
So I'm out there one day, and I see these caterpillars just devouring a plant. I think, oh, my God, I need to get rid of them. They're destroying my plants. So halfway back from the garage tearing my sprays, I said, you know, I need to Google what these caterpillars are because maybe I shouldn't kill them. And, of course, it turned out to be monarch caterpillars, and that's what got me hooked on gardening for wildlife and gardening for other species because the garden isn't a space just for me. It's a space for wildlife to thrive and to fulfill their life goals.
So that was definitely the turning point then for you for how you decided how to garden.
Yeah, from then on, I was researching every plant before I purchased it or placed it in the garden and making sure that it was providing for wildlife and both larvae, you know, the young of insects, but also adult insects, whether that be insects that eat others or eat leaves or use pollen or use nectar. I'm very strict now about what plants I include, and it usually tends to be native plants because they have the most bang for the buck.
Right. Now, the title of your book, A New Gardening Ethic, Cultivating Defiant Compassion for an Uncertain Future. Could you explain that a little bit? Because it's an unusual title.
It is an unusual title. Basically, it's not always easy, but it tends to be easier for humans to show empathy and compassion for one another, especially for family, for kids or parents or something. We will go out of our way to make sure that they have what they need to be happy and healthy. But it's a lot harder for us to think, okay, what does nature need to be happy and healthy? What does specific species need to be healthy and happy? What can I do to provide that for them? You know, we're living in a time of climate change and mass extinction, and we're losing, kids growing up today see 40% fewer butterflies than their parents did at the same age. So we are losing wildlife. We're losing organisms that sustain a healthy planet. So The defiant compassion is we live in a culture and society that says being an environmentalist is bad. It's this liberal crazy idea. You're a tree hugger. You're a hippie. Well, you need to be defiant. You need to say, no, I'm going to stand up. I'm going to say, I'm going to have a garden for other creatures and not just for myself.
Okay, great. Well, that would have been a long title, so I guess you picked the right one.
Yeah, it was already pretty long.
It was pretty long. Well, you know what we're going to do, Ben? We're going to go right to the phones because we have Kathleen in Delavan who wants to talk to us. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, good morning. Benjamin, with all due respect to your wife, this old lady thinks she has found her soulmate in you.
I can have two wives. It's okay.
It is such a challenge to acquaint people with the why we need to grow native plants in city gardens and suburban landscapes. Many people down here in southwestern Wisconsin are doing prairie restorations, which is awesome. But so many more people live, as you know, in the cities and suburbs. And so on my small lot, I have now around 150 species of, you know, vines, perennials, shrubs, everything, and trying to show people just so they can see all the different plants growing, you know, not just in a catalog. And it's such a challenge, though, to spread the message out because people just want to plug in a daylily or the latest cultivar, you know, from the big box stores. And so I think that it's people like you who are going to help advance this concept, and I congratulate you and laud you on it, and I'm looking forward to buying your book.
Oh, great. Marry me. You know, that's a good point. Our urban and suburban areas, we have so much lawn that's just there. It's this default landscape mode. And same thing for mulch. We have huge beds of just practically mulch, but we have all these areas that we could be doing so much more with, and it doesn't take any more resources. In fact, it takes far fewer resources and energy and time once these planted areas start growing. Do we need front lawns that we don't use? I had 1,000 square feet of front lawn took out because I never used it, so now it's prairie beds, and now there's goldfinches and butterflies out there all the time.
So what, you know, you've talked in your book a lot, you know, you get very kind of philosophical, and beautiful descriptions in your book, by the way. I really enjoyed that. What do you really think that a garden is for?
This my book certainly is deep and very philosophical, mm-hmm. lots of science and research, but a garden is for everybody. A garden is not just for humans. Our tradition of gardening is that it's a space where humans go to have refuge, to have peace, to just have a beautiful moment in the day. And while that certainly is what a garden is for, it no longer should be 100% that. It needs to be at least a 50-50 proposition, or maybe it's 50% for humans and 50% for other wildlife. What birds are going to be using the space? What insects? What spiders? What snakes? What wasps are going to be using the space? Because we need these creatures in our lives for multiple reasons.
Now, before I was actually read your book, I hadn't heard the term urban wildlife garden, and you've been mentioning some insects and things. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what the wildlife is in your garden? What, I mean, you're not trying to get raccoons in, right? Or are you?
Well, we have raccoons. I mean, raccoons aren't a goal, but it doesn't need to be a goal because they're
there.
Ubiquitous. They're everywhere. but I do see raccoons. Right here in Lincoln, Nebraska, it's a fairly compact urban city and suburban area. It doesn't really spread out too much, though it is getting worse in that regard. But right outside city limits, you have wild areas. You have parks and prairies and woodlands and creeks and streams. So wildlife that are using these areas are also going to use urban areas as wildlife corridors, habitat corridors, islands of refuge. So when I think of urban habitat, I think of spaces, and they don't have to be very big. They can be 100 square feet or they can be 10,000 square feet. But these spaces provide access for wildlife to move to other areas, to find shelter, to find temporary food. And, you know, I think just the act of understanding that these wildlife exists and that they have a right to exist as much as us is an act of defiant compassion right there, and a lesson for how we can treat each other too.
And so the types of animals you're talking about, insects also, birds, right?
Of course, yes, birds. You know, most people, when they think wildlife, they think birds. Of course, songbird populations are going down right alongside insect populations, because birds feed primarily insects to their young. The young are in the nest for 2 weeks, and if they're not getting 100, 200 caterpillars and spiders and bees a day to eat, they're just not going to grow and develop and be healthy.
And so what are some of the things that people can do if I've got this lawn, okay? So I want to make it more natural. I want to bring in some of these other wildlife, the bees and the insects. How can I start? Where do I begin? Because it just seems so overwhelming.
Oh, it's not overwhelming. Just jump in. It's like when you learn to swim, your dad just throws you in the water and says, go for it.
Go for it.
No, you can start small, because trust me, you're going to get hooked and go big soon enough. Starting small, I like to look at foundation beds around houses. Usually our foundation beds are really narrow. They're like maybe 3 feet deep or something. That provides absolutely no opportunity to provide diverse habitat or very many plants at all. So if we can extend our foundation beds out 6, 8, 10 feet, then that's going to give us immediate habitat right around the house for all kinds of things, like native bees especially, which are so important to pollination. So you can start there. You can even have an island out in the middle of the lawn. Start with that. Have an island that's 50 square feet or 100 square feet, and choose the native plants that you know will do well in that site condition. We're talking drainage, sunlight conditions, the type of soil you have. A lot of our native prairie plants love clay soil. I never amend any of my garden soils, because I'm choosing the native prairie plants that love to burrow down in that clay soil and over time naturally amend it on their own.
And those native plants are usually easier to take care of too, aren't they?
Well, that's not necessarily true. If they're put in the right place, then they're easier to take care of.
That's the key, right?
Yeah. You can't just say, it's a native plant, it's easy. You know, you got to make sure that, well, if this goldenrod liked dry prairie that's silty or loamy soil, then I need to make sure that's what I have in my landscape. And if it's not, then I need to find something else.
Okay. We're talking today with Benjamin Vogt. He writes a native plant gardening column, and he speaks nationally on sustainable design and wildlife landscape. He owns Monarch Gardens, a prairie design firm, and his new book is called A New Garden Ethic, Cultivating Defiant Compassion for an Uncertain Future. We'd like you to join our conversation, so give us a call. Our number, 1-800-642-1234, and of course, you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Joan Ledeau sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 11:45, we're going to take a look at a unique archival account of the early 20th century Northwoods. Hope you'll stay with us for that. Right now, we are talking to Ben Vogt about his new book. We're talking about wildlife in the garden in the city. So if you've got any questions or comments, if you have a garden like this, what's it done for you? Give us a call, because we'd like to hear from you. So, Ben, why did you decide to write this book?
Anger.
That's always a good reason.
Frustration. Just people always saying that it doesn't matter what you plant in your garden, just as long as it's pretty and it's sustainable, as far as not having to use fertilizers, not having to use as much water. I think every plant serves a great purpose. Every plant is incredibly important. And, you know, climate change, mass extinction, the fact that tall grass prairie is the most endangered ecosystem on the planet and the wildlife with it, we need to do something now. We need to reawaken our connection to other cultures, and other cultures would be other species, other plants and organisms. Otherwise, we have this great hole in our lives, this great absence, this great physical and spiritual absence, and we just can't have that in order to be a healthy and successful culture and society.
So for people who maybe live in some place where they can't have a garden, they're in an apartment or something, what can they do to get this connection with nature on a daily basis, maybe?
That if you have a deck, then you can put a couple of pots out there. Have an arrangement of maybe you have a milkweed in there with some grasses and an aster or something. Every plant matters, no matter where it is. You'll see wildlife come using these things. Obviously, if you don't have a lot where you can't do 1,000 square feet or something, then go out to the parks, go out to the wildlife refuges, and support these nonprofit organizations. I have some great organizations here near me that restore and conserve native prairies, and just giving them $50 a year is incredibly important.
Well, that's a great idea. And, you know, we've got another call. So let's go to Joni in Watertown. Hi, Joni.
Hi.
What comment do you have for us?
Yes, I have a great concern about the poisoning of the earth with sprays. I know that the corn and soy growers are poisoning the earth and widening their fields more and more, taking out all the milkweed. This is a major flyway for the monarchs, and their milkweed is gone now, so that's why we see so few of them. But when I was a little girl, my mother had me go out in the lawn with a little paring knife and a pan and pick all of the little, in the spring, pick all of the little broadleaves out of the lawn so that we could clean our system. She said this cleans your blood, and it's good for your liver and your kidney function and so forth after a long winter without greens. The earth provides us with that, and to poison every one of those little broadleaves in our lawn is a terrible thing that we're doing. They provide flowers for the insects, but they also provide something for us that's extremely important. Nature is providing for us, and we're poisoning it out. So I'm also concerned about the County Highway Commission going through and taking down all of the wildflowers and so forth that are growing on the roadsides. And they seem to be taking out wider and wider swaths and doing it several times over the summer and fall. And a lot of milkweed is being taken out there. I'm sure there are some eggs on those milkweed leaves that are being chopped up and destroyed. So that is my concern.
Thank you. Thank you, Joni. Ben, what do you think about that?
That's my concern. That's a big concern for me, too, man. I every time I'm driving down the highway with my wife and I see them mowing roadside edges where that spring, summer, or fall, I do have a tendency to swear sometimes, and I maybe shouldn't. But, they're usually highway crows, I know. I think they're supposed to mow late summer after most grassland birds who might be nesting on the edges of the highways, especially if it's a huge edge, are done nesting. But yes, there are seeds in the fall that birds are going to be eating and that need to fly around and reseed the areas. And mowing of our highway edges, it's just a travesty, and I think it happens too often. And for a lot of people, that can become a very heated debate, especially when you're discussing changing policy, because not mowing as often means not using as much gas and spewing all those nasty chemicals out into the air.
And what do you say if people are on the other side, say, well, we have to keep these down because it's a safety issue?
I've read a study that said freshly mowed highway edges are actually more attractive to deer because it's a fresh mown space and there's new growth coming up, and the deer prefer that new growth because it's more nutritious. That's one aspect. New Mexico has, I'm trying to remember how many thousands of miles of roadside they were doing, but they planted it in native grasses, and they found that having those native grasses on the edge of the roads was actually sequestering up to 350% of the carbon being released from cars driving by on the highways. So you're cleaning the air by having these things there, and you're also reducing the polluted runoff that's coming off of interstates that's going to be going into our groundwater, going into our lakes and rivers, because, you know, there's oils and chemicals coming off the cars all the time. And if we have the grasses and the flowers on the side of the road, they're going to greatly help filter all that nasty runoff.
Do you think that having statistics like the ones you were just talking about would be helpful to bring to governments and say, hey, you know, this can do this. Here's the positives. Do you think that's a really good way of doing some change?
I think that's half of it. Statistics apply to one side of our brain and to a certain kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
I also think we need stories. I think we need emotion. I think we need our hearts engaged in this. When you're mowing those roadside edges, when you're taking away habitat, you are taking away your state, you're taking away your town, you're taking away your region, you're erasing the place you profess to love and profess to take care of. And what are the stories that we can use about specific wildlife or family stories or histories or cultural histories of place and settlement? What are those stories that we can use to make that argument alongside the statistics?
Okay, well, let's go back to the phones, Ben. We've got Linda from Madison on the line. Hi, Linda. What's your question?
Hi. I live next to the railroad tracks, and there's always an area between the tracks and, you know, where your property starts. And I've planted things back there for me, and I always wondered then, are you eating healthy stuff considering what's in the soil? And I really wonder, I'd like to plant a lot more, at this point, just prairie plants back there. But, you know, considering what could be in the soil from the, you know, the trains, is it healthy for them?
What do you think, Ben?
That I honestly don't know, and I'm okay saying I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much filtering is going on in the plants. And
Linda,
you
should have your soil tested. That might be the best way to go about that.
Yes, that's a good idea.
Mm-hmm. That way you know, because I imagine it's different next to every railroad track.
And, you know, and railroad tracks, those edges and those rights of way are great habitat for native plants that don't have a chance anywhere else. So,
okay, well, Linda, great. That's great. You know what? We get that checked and report back to us and see how that works for you, okay?
All right.
All right. Thanks, Linda. We've got Chris from Grafton on the line. Hi, Chris.
Hi. How are you doing?
Well, what's your question?
First, thanks for taking my call. My question is, I live in a small condo community. We're on like 22 acres. And right now, albeit we do not mow by far any of the full acreage, what we do is it's standard for as far as the chemicals to keep weeds down and the likes of that. Okay. But that costs us money too. Okay. And are there books that can show that it's actually more economical not to do that type of stuff? And even if it is to improve the value of the land through bringing in more butterflies and the likes.
Okay, well, thank you, Chris. Ben, were you able to hear that question okay?
Yes, okay. I heard that.
Okay.
That was a really good question that I can't completely answer. I read a study a long time ago that showed an apartment complex for 1 acre of lawn that's maintained, it's like $20,000 over 20 years or something. That can't be right, but it was significantly less if you're putting it in the prairie or garden beds. Some books to look at are certainly Doug Ptolemy's Bringing Nature Home, Planting in a Post-Wild World by Thomas Rainer and Claudia West, Garden Revolution by Larry Weiner and Thomas Christopher. Those are some good places to start to create those arguments to further your good goals. Maybe even Richard Louv's. What's that book? Do you know that book by Richard Louv?
I don't.
Nature Deficit Disorder. Last Child in the Woods. That's the name of the book.
Okay. All right. Well, there's quite a few of them there for you, Chris. Hopefully you can get some help on that. And do you think it's slowly changing, Ben? Are people looking at landscape a little bit different now than they did, say, 15 years ago?
Very, very, very slowly. Mm-hmm. And it needs to happen a lot faster. I'm an activist, you know. I want these things to happen faster.
Sure.
I know the pressures that we're under. So I told you before that I took our front lawn out and put it in the native prairie beds. And the reason that started was May of 2015, we got a letter from County Weed Control. A neighbor reported us because our lawn was a little too long. We had a few too many dandelion seed heads, which really weren't that many. And that really irked me. So because the lawn wasn't doing anything, I didn't use it, and it certainly didn't help wildlife. So over the summer, I worked on my wife, and eventually in the fall, she said, go ahead, do what you want. So put in those native prairie beds and have not had one complaint since then. And I don't know if that's justification for what I did or not, but I have not had a complaint. Of course, when I designed those beds, the flowers were in clumps and masses and drifts, so it looked designed. There's a lawn pathway going up the middle, so it shows that the lawn still connects to the rest of suburban lawn. It's still meant for human use. And there's, I've written articles on how you can, specific strategies you can use to make your wilder landscape look less wild and be more palatable to humans.
So it looks like it's cared for. Do you think that maybe is the key there?
Yeah, cared for, and of course there's, you know, traditional design elements, not just plants in clumps and drifts, but you're also doing taller plants in the back of the border or in the middle of a bed, and nothing is you know, falling over into the sidewalk. There's nothing tall on the edge of the sidewalk or driveway because people don't really like to be touched by plants. I don't know why.
It's the icky factor. It's the icky.
Yeah,
what is that? Is that a bug?
Is that a bug? Yeah. You know, I've had bees land on my arm, and it's been totally cool. We just hang out together, you know?
Yeah, I think that fear is probably, well, some people are just a little more afraid than others about that. But we're talking with Benjamin Vogt today. He has written a book called A New Garden Ethic, Cultivating Defiant Compassion for an Uncertain Future. And he writes a native plant gardening column, and he speaks nationally on sustainable design and wildlife landscape. Now, you own a landscape design firm, Monarch Gardens. What's your philosophy for creating a garden for someone else? How do you go about that?
Well, I've been pretty lucky so far. The folks that are contacting me have pretty much been giving me carte blanche, saying, you know, do what you're going to do. I've looked at your pictures. I've read your philosophy, you know, which is all about what my book is, and I want that wildlife habitat. Some folks want it a little bit more designed. Some folks want it, are okay with it being a little bit wilder looking. So I just try and give them the plants that I know are going to do well there and emulate as best I can the prairie look. And sometimes that can be a short prairie. It's usually not very tall, especially when I'm doing front yards. I try to keep things shorter so it doesn't look totally crazy.
Do you think that people really should find themselves an expert before they start, or can they just, you know, Google it, get books? What do you think works?
Both. I think knowledge is power, and it gives you confidence to talk with an expert. So read a couple books first. If you want to dabble, go ahead and go for it. If you live in a neighborhood with an HOA, homeowners association, and you're really worried about it, I would definitely consult with an expert, and you can just. A lot of designers will just do a consult with you, and some will go ahead and design the landscape and put it in for you, or you can put it in yourself. That's how I work. So it just depends on sort of how formal you need that space to look, how mm-hmm. designed it needs to look.
Okay. And we had talked up earlier, too, about what gardens do for a person, and you also talk about what they do for a community as a whole. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, there have been studies that show when you have green spaces in urban areas, crime drops within several blocks of that green space. Property values increase. We all know the value of trees in our home landscapes, where I think it's something like one inch caliper on a tree equals $1,000 of home value, mm-hmm. which seems crazy, but
it does.
And then it does. Plant those trees. They're
good.
And then, of course, there's kids who look out of classrooms. When they have views of diverse nature, trees and shrubs and flowers and prairie grasses and butterflies and birds flying all around, those kids looking out of classroom windows are going to be more creative, have higher test scores, they're going to work better in groups, they're going to lessen symptoms of ADHD, and hopefully they'll eat their vegetables when they come home and talk back less to their parents. I don't know.
You can only put it on your wish list, right?
Yeah, it's a wish list. Put it on your Christmas list.
Yeah, exactly. So I was interested in how you talk about bumblebees and honeybees, and I think people kind of get them mixed up. And, you know, why don't you talk a little bit about the case for the bees?
The case for the bees. We have imported European honeybees, and we use them, we stress them out in incredible levels, using them as a cog in an industrial agricultural machine to pollinate lots of our crops. We truck them around the country. They're eating pollen that's covered in pesticides and even insecticides and all kinds of nasty stuff. Well, I don't necessarily believe in the end we need to be using honeybees. We don't even need to have them here. We have 4,000 species of native bees that collectively are far better, far more efficient pollinators than honeybees ever can be. We can have 250 native Blue Orchard Mason bees that pollinate 1 acre of apples, whereas it could take 10 to 20,000 honeybees to do the same job. So native bees tend to be, they don't have a hive to defend, so they tend to be much less aggressive. They're not out to sting you. They're just like, yo, dude, cool. You do your thing in the garden. I'm going to go over here and do my nectar thing.
Uh-huh.
So they're very, and even only female bees have stingers. So that drops the risk down even more.
It does. It definitely does. Oh, we've got a few more callers here. So let's go to George. Hi, George. What's your question?
Yes, good morning to you. It's a wonderful day. The sun is shining, and I have a story about this spring in my wildflower garden up on the hill by the orchard. And I went up there, and I was standing by the garden, and I looked to the side, and there was something white. It was a milkweed that was pure white and very silky and lacy. And it was 3 years ago that my wife passed away, and we put her ashes up on this hill. And I just wondered if she has come to me just to say something, that I'm still with you.
Oh, well, thank you for sharing that story with us, George. Ben, I think you had a story in your book about milkweed too, didn't you?
I don't know. Did I? What was it?
Oh, it was growing in the median strip or something by the front yard, and couldn't decide whether to keep it there or transplant it.
Yeah, I had a common milkweed come up in the hell strip, that space between the street and the sidewalk. And I decided to finally, I really wanted to just let it grow out there and sort of say, hey, neighborhood, it doesn't have to be like this. But no, I dug it up and I put it in the backyard, but I waited too long. I killed it. The taproot, it was already too tall and the taproot too deep, and I cut that taproot, and it didn't take in the backyard. So
yeah. So what lesson did you learn from that?
Transplant much sooner.
Yeah, don't wait. Do it now.
Don't wait, yeah.
Okay, well, let's go to... Thank you, George, for that call. Lynn in Eau Claire is with us. Hi, Lynn.
Hello. Lovely story from George.
Yes.
Ben, we have... And my grandkids go out and pick milkweed pods to broadcast. I mean, it's a wonderful thing. But we have neighbors behind us who actually removed trees, moved their fence back 3 feet onto the property line because I asked them not to come into my yard to spread Agent Orange. And, we just don't like your weeds coming into our yard. They're not my weeds. And how good does one deal? I just say, hell with it. And it's a healthy, happy lawn. It's a healing space.
Okay, thank you, Lynn, very much. Ben, have you had problems? Have you dealt with that in the different gardens that you've made?
Luckily, not so far. I mean, fences do make good neighbors, of course, but it sounds like that fence is over the property line, so you need to have somebody come out there and spray that property line and have that fence moved. Of course, it's very tricky. It's very easy to let our passions lead to anger and just want to yell at our neighbors. So somehow we have to just tell stories, invite them into the garden, show them what the plants are and what the plants are doing and what the purpose is, and share a beer, share a lemonade, share a tea, and just try and open and pry open, get a crack in the door, a crack in the fence to showing other people that how important these spaces are. And it can take 20 times. There are actually psychological studies that show it takes 20 times to see a piece of information that contradicts our beliefs before we start to change our beliefs. So 20 times, work on it.
20 times, count them off. And we've got Kate calling from Menasha. Hi, Kate.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think the prairie plantings are fantastic, and I love what this author's doing. It sounds awesome. I did want to put in a plug for regular old cultivated plants. I'm a perennial gardener, and I cut some dahlias late in the season, brought them in, and I was astounded how many bugs were on those plants. I just felt really good about my pretty flowers actually being home to beetles and flies and all kinds of things. So that's it.
Okay, thank you, Kate. So
yeah, that's good to hear. And I'd also wonder what kind of insects are using those dahlias, and are they exotic insects we brought in? Are they native insects? How are they using the plant? Are they reproducing on the plant as well? These are all questions to try and figure out, are we using the best possible plants that we could be using?
So, you know, we've got a little bit of time left, not too much longer, but why don't you tell me what you would like your book to do for those who read it?
I really want this book is a lot like Aldo Leopold, Sand County Almanac, and Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. I see it as sort of a blending of the two and a sort of a catapulting of the two. I want people to radically rethink the power and efficacy of the landscapes, the places, the land that they own, the land that they take care of. Is that land welcoming to everybody? How can it be a piece of defiant compassion, a piece of activism that bridges the different cultures of human and animal, human and plant, human and water, human and air? So I just want us to think in new ways and to be uncomfortable thinking in new ways, because that's when we make the most progress in our lives.
Great. Well, thank you for that. And I agree with you, reading the book, it does make you think and look at things in different ways than you probably have been for a long time. So thank you for that. And thank you for being with us today. We've been talking with Ben Vogt. He writes a native plant gardening column and speaks nationally on sustainable design and wildlife landscape. He owns Monarch Gardens, a prairie design firm. And his new book is A New Garden Ethic, Cultivating Defiant Compassion for an Uncertain Future. Thanks again for joining us, Ben. Coming up next, we're going to take a look at a unique archival account of canoe journeys in the early 20th century Northwoods. Hope you can stay with us on the Ideas Network.